Chapter 16. In the first few weeks, you had created a new cipher, based off the original, with a few mathematical changes just in case Ianthe had gleaned too much data from the envelopes. In this, you started to collate your thoughts and findings on the lictors around you, a pitiful memorandum of opinion and perceived fact, mostly useless, gathered in the hope that by examining your findings in aggregate, you might somehow receive wisdom. You had always liked to write notes. You grieved the loss of your diary from Canaan House, but your things had been filtered through Ianthe back to you, which meant that all you got was a small supply of sacramental paint and your old clothes. When you inquired about the diary, you received the blunt response that it had been burned on your own orders. Your section on Ianthe was very short. Ianthe, whilom Tridentarius the First. Unworthy of trust. Suspects me mad. You should have known the former, and the latter was all your own fault. The first slip was the matter of Kithareia's tomb. The Emperor had laid the corpse of Kithareia the First in a small chamber off the central residential atrium, a little too close for comfort. This atrium was a well of corridor shafts off to other rings of the station, and its floor was an exquisite mandala of hand bones under glass. Each metacarpal dyed the colour of its house, dominated by ombres of white to crimson for the second and white to navy for the fourth. Around the mandala were tiles of raised brown stone that rapped sharply when one stepped on them. There were no windows to speak of, just strong electric lights from round holes in the ceiling, and in the middle hung a delicate chandelier of white crystals. The room was pillared with three massive steel-edged columns on either side, each a cacophony of exposed wire under smoked glass. These wires were thronged about with bone, with glistening strands of fat wrapped around some of the threads of copper instead of plex. They reeked of naked thallergy, and their purpose was still not immediately apparent to you. Every so often, a whole arm bone would peek out of this nest of soft yellow fat-wrapped wire. You assumed it was not another memorial. There were nine decorative arches on the eastmost side of the room. You had by now investigated each arch carefully. The brown floor tiles were inlaid halfway up the walls in these arches, and then became glass of every different colour, and in the centre of each polychromatic sweep was a sword bracket. Some of the brackets were empty, and some held rapiers. One in particular always drew you back to it. A black rapier with a basket hilt formed of ebon wires. At the termination of each wire was a single canine tooth, and the end, pommel, was a soft, worn knob of black-dyed bone. The side room they put Kithareia in was not so decorated. The door was always open to reveal her laid out on a stretcher, with candles all around her that never seemed to go out or melt down, covered by those chubby blush rosebuds that also never seemed to open or rot. In these two miracles, you detected the hand of the Emperor Divine. Every so often you saw him in there, having a quiet conversation with the body in the same way one would talk to a sleeping child. Sometimes Augustine was there, and once Mercy. You never saw the other. You had ventured in there yourself often, even though it was gauche, even though you had done enough damage. Something about her troubled you, and you thought it was the paranoid madness, but you couldn't be sure. Your brain told you that the arms so chastely crossed over that skewered chest had been moved a little. Your brain told you that the lips were a little too parted. When you had told teacher of your worries, you little imbecile, he had grimaced and worried his forehead with his thumb momentarily and said, "Nobody would touch her, Harrow. I haven't." "I know, I just—" "Augustine wouldn't out of love," he said, Mercy wouldn't, out of superstition. And Autus. He looked at you carefully, as always when he mentioned the other. The name always came awkwardly to his lips. Autus wouldn't, out of respect, believe me. He wouldn't even think of such a thing. Doesn't sound Ianthe's style either.
But I think
perhaps you should try to avoid that room, he had suggested sympathetically. You had burned. You had been molten with shame and resentment. You had been reduced entirely to flame. Yet for all that, you now walked devoutly past the doorway where lay the peaceful corpse of Kithareya the First. You entered that doorway in your waking nightmares, watched, lost in the hallucination of your mind's eye, as those frozen fingers twitched into arcane formations, as each bare toe on each chilly foot shivered as though the corpse had been touched with an electrified wire. Your mistake was the time you stopped just outside the room, arrested by muffled creaks at the edges of your hearing. Tortured past any shame, you turned to Ianthe and said,
"Do you perceive any sound from within the mortuary chapel?"
She said, "Do you try to sound as portentous as possible, or does it just sort of happen naturally?"
"Answer the damn question, Tridentarius!"
You did not call her Tridentarius outside of a locked room, so she looked at you queerly and said, "No." And then, as though more enlightened by what she saw in your face, gently, "No, I don't, crazy cakes." And you did not ask her again. There was so much more you might have written.
"Eyes have not reverted to lilac since the river. Arm is continued weak point, still cries at night. Cannot actually be anemic, considering diet primarily red meat and apples. Regularly undersleeps. Begrudges my relationship with teacher. Knows too much."
Your other sections were more substantial.
"Augustine Wylam Quinque, the First, Saint of Patience. Why?"
The name had been easy to get. You had simply found him at his mid-afternoon cup of tea and cigarette. The Saint of Patience was as regular as a worm and had no apparent fear of fire, or having to regrow his own taste buds, and asked him outright.
"Ah, finally my biographer," he had said, rubbing his hands together in a show of deep satisfaction. "I've been waiting for this, Harrowhark. Augustine, Augustine. Height, 6 feet. Visage can be described as attractive but grave. Eyes can be scenarious. And if you're appreciative of poor little Kith's tradition..."
She was always poor little Kith while he smiled and looked directly at you.
"It's Augustine Alfred. Alfred was 5'10". Let's get that down for posterity. He was my other half. Get that down too, for the human interest aspect."
You were momentarily revolted by the apparent fifth house tradition.
"You and your cavalier were wedded."
He did not turn a hair at wedded, or, as Ianthe would, say back exactly what you had in a high-pitched voice, for which you would one day jerk her white and beating heart from her colourless ribcage and eat it dripping before her. You did not examine "eat it dripping," as you maybe should have done. He just laughed in the uproarious slap-your-thigh way that the Saint of Patience always laughed. It was not a laugh that really ever seemed to find anything genuinely funny. When this peal of performative humour had died down, Augustine said, "Bless you, sis. He was my brother."
"Killed own sibling." Augustine I was the closest thing you had ever experienced to human plex. On the outside, he was perfectly painted in a sort of antique fifth house style, all manners and politesse and over-easy familiarity. Yet there was nothing inside him but an equally easy contempt.
It was as though 10,000 years had built up a shell and left a space at the centre. Nothing seemed to touch Augustine. He was effervescent and charming in a way you found a little tedious in Flip, especially on those teeth-grinding occasions when God called you all to eat a social meal together. But there was never any real emotion, or reaction, or opinion. His mouth said one thing, and his face could contort itself into any number of silly expressions, but those eyes were devoid of substance. Cinereus was at least correct. Ash also looked solid upon first glance, but was insubstantial filth on contact.
Poor relationship with Mercy Morn.
You had written this understatement of the myriad when you thought that highly strung Mercy was easily out of patience with the sillier and more frivolous Augustine in those first few weeks. He cultivated a specific expression whenever Mercy Morn was talking, an expression that was meant to say to all assembled, "At least we suffer together." And that more than once you had seen Ianthe smother a laugh at, so comical was the mouth. But that was the painted-on expression. The plex had been shaped differently. Though you often saw them pass in the hallway as if the other did not exist, you once spied a different encounter while safely ensconced in an alcove. They'd stopped in front of each other, with Mercy trying to pass left. Augustine made himself intangibly too much left to pass. Mercy trying to pass right. Augustine made himself intangibly too much right to pass, and Mercy saying tightly, "Get out of my way, you miserable ass." Augustine had said something you did not catch, but then something you did. Back to the bad old tricks of decades past.
"Oh, as if you're my keeper, you chattering imbecile."
"But does John know, my child?" said the saint of patience, smiling. Mercy had bristled, the nacreous whites of her robe visibly shivering.
"That," she said, "is a foul implication."
"I'm not implying anything. Does John—"
"And it's obscene the way you call him that when—"
"Mercy Morn," said Augustine lightly. "I won't fall for any of your worn-out tricks, my girl. Now look, do I have to kill you before you get us both in trouble or not?"
From your vantage point, you could see that the Saint of Joy's face was a stiff white oval. Those hurricane eyes roiled within a face that was trembling and fixed. You could not see Augustine's.
She said, "Don't threaten me."
"Or what? You'll tell Daddy?"
His tone of voice hadn't changed.
"Good grief. You wouldn't get close enough to touch me, Mercy Morn. No, I am not afraid of you. You are not very nice, but you are also not very clever when it comes down to it. I'm going to give you 3 recommendations. 1 is to be in my airspace less. 2 is to stop messing around with Kith's body. 3 is to stop playing the rather dangerous game you're playing, the one you said you'd stop."
"I won't do a thing you say."
She sounded tearful now.
"Don't pull that face. I know you like I know my own soul. You're thinking, if I move now, can I touch his neck before he can stop me? And hey-ho, there goes my trachea. It wouldn't matter even if you were quick enough on the draw, you know."
"As though you could ever—"
"If you killed me, I don't think he'd forgive you, you see," said Augustine. The easy, confidential tone of voice had gone. It was now flat and immovable and bored. "But if I killed you, if I stubbed you out beneath my foot, which would still be more than you deserve, then I am convinced that it would take me a mere 100 years to get John to say, 'I know why you did it, old chap, and I'm sorry,' and for everything to come up, Augustine. You have shot your bolt too many times."
"How dare—"
"You have rendered yourself unlovable, Mercy," said Augustine. "You're the second saint.
He's sentimental over you, but don't forget that he spent the last 10,000 years on a perpetual search-and-destroy mission out of, as far as I can tell, purely symbolic retribution. John is never as sentimental as you think. Do you need me to write this down for you so you can read it to yourself each night? You are unnecessary to him. Worse still, you've become an embarrassment. I wouldn't set myself up as his replacement AL. He doesn't need another bodyguard, and even she was significantly more lucid than you are. You'd expected a response. None came. You looked at the Saint of Joy, and at her expression, withdrew into your alcove, flattening yourself, lest she pick you as a target to vent her frustrations on. There was a silence from the corridor. Then Augustine broke it. Stay away from me, Joy. I find myself so profoundly tired of looking at your face. And his clickety-clackety bootsteps sounded down the corridor. Mercy Morn's voice floated back, somewhat strangled. But I haven't even touched Kitherea. Afterward, you stopped seeing them in the same room, except when the Necrolord Prime called you together for dinner, and then they sat as far apart as possible.
Favours Ianthe. A source of continuing annoyance to you. You'd never been anybody's favourite anything, and did not intend to start. But the idea that the Princess of Ida had managed to capture another's affection was bilious. Yet from the very start, Augustine had inclined toward her, and she had deployed her whole menagerie of coquettish smiles in return, each looking as though it had spent a month prowling the desert before being captured and put to this circus use. She was often seen at his side, fully absorbed in whatever pearls of wisdom were dropping from the Saint of Patience's lips, drinking calamitous amounts of hot tea with much the same expression, one you thought ill-suited to her shadowed eyes and white mouth, and though less calmly, taking instruction in the long training hall with its polished wooden floorboards, the wood so new you were hesitant to step on it. It was only then that they seemed at odds, as the so-called Saint of Patience ran out of it every time Ianthe put hand to rapier. He smoked his fierce cigarettes as he put her through her paces. She was always so tremendously bored by sword exercises. I thought the point was to outsource this, elder brother. You had heard her remark more than once. He would get cross quickly. From what little you could tell, her form was perfect. Her lines were exquisite. She never dropped the sword or fumbled with it, which proved again how inadequate a standard what little you could tell was. But there was something he did not like about how that right arm clutched that sword. Let go, you heard him tell her once. I'm assuming you mean metaphorically. Younger sister, he said cordially. Some nice boy spent his life learning that sword for you. Now you are trying to add your opinions to his, and they are simply not worth half a toot in this hot and terrible universe. Stop holding it like it smells, or like a banana you're trying to burst. Emperor almighty, Ianthe, I've seen you do this perfectly, so why must you persist in doing it poorly? At that, she had said a rude word, flung the sword down, and fled. Augustine finished his cigarette in a ruminative manner, and you stared at the rapier you had been given. The Emperor asked you to handle it, so you scheduled some time for handling it, with absolutely jack shit arising from the exercise. She can do it, you know, he remarked to the air. She simply needs to quit steeping in self-pity. You said, humiliating her is perhaps not the best curative. Harrow Hark, he said, smiling, tapping his cigarette out on the skull of some long-dead cohort hero.
If Ianthe's opinion isn't worth a fart in a hurricane, try to imagine how much less I value yours.
So far away from Dreba, so far from your congregation and the elders and laypeople who had blushed to kiss your knucklebone prayer beads, you felt you actually had valuable information in this instance. But Ianthe's secrets were not held in common for you to spill so thoughtlessly.
Then that is your downfall, you said.
You are Anastasia come again.
In a perfect world, Augustine's cool would have warmed Mercy Morn toward you. She did cultivate a distaste for Ianthe, but did not become any less shrill, acid, or contemptuous in your direction. Naturally, a large portion of your education fell to her. With Augustine busy, there was nobody left for you. But she more than once expressed her view that Augustine had nabbed the working baby on purpose and left her the dregs to spite her. Once when you were tired, you had said to Ianthe,
"Doesn't it chafe, carrying on after him the way you do, picking up his things, smiling with your teeth showing?"
"My teeth are extremely white, and I brush assiduously, so I see no problem showing them off," said Ianthe.
"Lighting his cigarettes and cooing. That is so fascinating, elder brother."
"I intend to take on the habit myself," said Ianthe. "Cigarettes. On a space station. What a power play."
"Do you ever wake up and think to yourself, when did the Princess of Ida become this grovelling slime?"
She smiled at you, with those teeth so brushed and white. The eyes that had once been chill lavender were now blue, patted with brown flecks and as mocking as ever. "Most days," she said. "Oh, for crying out loud, Harrowhark, smiling and listening to some quite interesting stories about his 10,000 years is no hardship. Especially not when it may make him think twice about leaving me to be eaten by a resurrection beast. Carrying off Corona's con for over 20 years taught me that shame is a privilege. We're puppies, you and I. I with my lame paw, and you with 3 legs missing, insisting you can make it on your own. And God help us both, because we are surrounded by wolves." Ianthe ended this startling speech by chucking you under the chin. You were too outraged and befuddled to dodge her. She said, "Show your endearing side, Harry. It may save your life."
Spirit magician. Another terrible understatement. Augustine was a spirit magician like the Mithraeum was a box with some bones. You did not begrudge him this expertise. Spirit magic had never been your forte. He had a lictor's power and a myriad's refinement. He taught to a curriculum you had barely known existed. The dead Harrowhark of your letters had told you to take instruction, and so did God, shepherding you and Ianthe both to take lessons from the Mithraeum's resident expert in resurrection beasts.
"It's not my primary wheelhouse," Augustine explained. "But since our last expert vanished into a large intestine, unravelled by a troop of ghosts, I'm the last spirit adept standing."
"He's being modest," said God. "The barriers between us and the river are Augustine's. He could plunge half a city into it if he wanted."
"What a gorgeously futile idea," said Augustine warmly. "I should chuck things in there more often. There's no way that could come back to haunt me. No, my lord, I am not Cassiopeia. I am a spirit generalist, and happy with my lot."
"So we're talking about ghosts and liminal spaces and hell," Ianthe said. Ianthe always wanted everything brought back to liminal spaces and hell, as though her rooms were not enough. "You could not deny an interest yourself." The saint of patience never took this bait.
"Dear one, I need the right moment to go to hell, but ghosts and spirits are as good a place as any to begin.
You might say I like to follow energy trails back to their source. Revenants in particular are fun that way. Resurrection beasts feed like revenants. They find thalogenic planets and guzzle them up wholesale, crack them open like clams, and take the soul for meat. Then they turn all that remnant thalogy into what we call the corpus, or the hive, and the thanergy, the dead clam itself, for armour. You can ask the Saint of Duty about the thanergy transfer.
You did not think this would be viable.
When you look at a revenant on this side, what you're seeing is the thanergy mass that it's gathered. Usually, revenants can only inhabit things connected to them in life. The best and most desirable would be its own corpse or skeleton, or planet, if you're an RB. You've formed a bond with that thing through habit and genetics. It's your soul's preferred housing. Unfortunately, aponeumatic shock makes most of us do a blind dash away from the site of our deaths, resurrection beasts included. The card up the sleeve of the revenant and the resurrection beast is that it can inhabit anything it's got a connection to, anything thanergetically connected with their death. Ianthe suggested in what you saw as a low-value suck-up play. Burial implements, grave goods, any possession that they kept over time that was exposed to their thalogy and thanergy. If they were murdered, the murder weapon.
Bang on, said Augustine.
Even things that touched the murder weapon, though the connection's fairly weak there, and the revenant would have to be particularly bloody-minded.
She pressed.
Could they use thanergy they generated after death? Thanergy directly related to themselves. I mean, things they kill.
You are absolutely and beautifully right, said the Saint of Patience warmly, and you were not annoyed that she had won such approbation. It was not as though your brain had failed to come to the same conclusion. You simply hadn't felt like articulating.
This is how the RBs got on, having scarpered away from the Dominicus system. Resurrection beasts add to their corpus anything they've done a good solid murder to. They eat planets, they suck up the thanergy, then add bits of the planet to themselves, getting bigger and meaner each time. Your average revenant doesn't kill human beings and stick them on its outside, for which I'm devoutly thankful. The last time we eyeballed number 7, it was over 50,000 kilometres in diameter.
This is why you will be sent out to establish the perimeter, said God, as Augustine was lost in 50,000 kilometres of reverie. We can slow number 7 if we take away its food. If we flip a planet all at once, a thalogetic death, the resurrection beast will ignore it. This is the way we used to prepare a thalogy planet for necromancy, God explained to you much later, after Mercy began schooling you in the way of butchering planetoids. No adept can perform any substantive work if they're reduced to scavenging trace thanergy. Even a master of the ninth can only do so much with a few scattered bones. So back at the start, we'd drop in a single lictor, unnoticed, to start the thanergy reaction. Not to flip the whole planet, you understand, just to get the juice flowing. He made a hand gesture for get the juice flowing, which made your head hurt. Then, within an hour or two, you could send down a team of adepts and be confident they'd have all the reserves they needed. Nowadays, we can't afford to use lictors, so the first strike falls to the men and women of the cohort, and they do a magnificent job. But the old way was neater, and kinder too, I think.
Ianthe said, if the resurrection beast is that big, surely the main worry is that we'll be drawn into its gravity well.
Yes, but it almost never travels as a physical revenant. That's why it's so damned hard to track beasts. Much easier if they'd just leave flattened galaxies in their wake. They travel as river projections instead. Periscoping, Cass called it. And once they do instantiate, they don't seem to want to get too close. This is where the heralds come in. Unlike normal revenants, our bees have developed external actors, and those are the things that will attack the Mithraeum. We've nicknamed this the Hive, and inside the Hive are the heralds. They'll look like independent creatures, but really, they're just extensions of it. Spider, web, hand, finger. This whole lesson took place with you, God, and Ianthe sitting at the dining table, which still smelled like breakfast, and you did not like the lack of ceremony. Augustine was leaning over the table, drawing a careful diagram on a piece of flimsy with a pencil he had borrowed from God. The resulting sketch was almost impossible to follow.
"You keep saying creatures," you said. "That is a little..."
"Nondescript," said Augustine. "I can't describe them, sis. The first time we ran into the tools of a resurrection beast, and this was just looking at them, I mean, they hadn't even engaged us, I watched a lictor, one I had never hitherto seen so much as cry out, scream like a colicky child. Another two, R.I.P. since, simply vomited." God added, "The heralds and corpus sometimes vary between beasts. They are the dead parts their centre has mashed together. Some lictors have seen them as insectoid. They're monstrous and deadly, and there are often hundreds of them. Thousands." Once upon a time, you might have asked questions. Good, interesting, thorny questions. The difficult ones that showed you knew something and could be relied upon to run where you were directed, blindfolded. This time, you kept blessedly quiet. "And they only halfway matter," said the Emperor, vindicating your choice. "Certainly, they're dangerous. If you are devoured by the heralds, I cannot bring you back. But you can destroy them easily enough if you've a blade and the facility to use it. Or necromancy. But as a lictor, of course, your necromancy is needed elsewhere." "Would you like to teach this one, John?" said Augustine patiently.
"No, sorry. Keep going."
"I mean, I love the tack you're taking. I hadn't thought to scare the living wee out of them with 'they'll eat you alive,' starting with your feet."
Sorry. Go on."
Briefly smiling at God, Augustine pointed at the diagram. "The part of the resurrection beast that we can destroy squats in the river, ladies," he said. "Just as the most important part of the revenant is where the soul is, the most important part of the resurrection beast is sitting over here. You'll leave your bodies, which protect you nonetheless, your good old calves right there in your neurons and amygdala, ready to come out for exactly such a happenstance, and they'll fight it much better than you can because they're immune to herald fear. I have lived for a very long time, and when I see a herald, I still get the most appalling whim-whams. My cavalier doesn't care. I removed the part of him that did when I became a lictor. That's his main advantage. Your body can't and won't use necromancy without you. The power doesn't flow both ways."
Ianthe said, "But if we're in the river, then the ghosts..."
"You're a projection. They can't hurt you," said the king, undying. "And you won't even see them. No ghost will approach a beast submerged."
He sat back in his chair. God had a quiet, ambling posture, an upright, if slightly stoop-shouldered gait. He was mobile and alive. He was always somehow more alive than everyone else around him, and yet dislocated from what you considered living. A man-shaped eclipse.
"And there we fight it," he said simply. "Much like fighting anything else."
Augustine said, "You ward against it. You hack up whatever it points in your direction. You wither its false flesh. It has form as we have form in the river, and it's vulnerable the same way we are. You get a good tight grip on its soul, and you pull the damn thing to pieces. In the end, if you wear it down, you exorcise it altogether. It is a revenant. a revenant of a specific hell. The Emperor said,
Once defeated, it can be forced down into the abyss, and from there it will not return.
We hope, said Augustine. Oh, Lord, do we ever hope.